Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Here we are in the midst of winter, and, you know, for a lot of people, drought's still on their minds. Certainly, it's something I've thought about and talked about with other people over the last several days, actually. And, you know, you think about garden issues. You get this long drought. What needs to be done? What do we have to do? What do you and I have to do in the garden or in the lawn? Larry Mueller here, by the way. Welcome to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you join us, and I'm really glad to have Lisa Johnson with us. Lisa, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. She specializes in helping out the home gardener, and so whether you're interested in veggies or flowers or woody ornamentals or lawns or trees, she will give you some great advice to share. You can join in, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org with a question, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And Lisa, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry.
I really appreciate it. Some of us got a lot of snow all at once a few weeks back.
We sure did.
Yeah, and chances are all of us around the state have had at least a few significant snowfalls this winter. Still, though, probably need to worry a little bit about the plants.
Well, now that our snow cover has sort of disappeared and the temperature is going to drop, that's going to be potentially an issue for perennials that are semi-evergreen, for example, or newly planted things that might heave out of the ground. We do worry a little bit about the freeze-thaw thing can be an issue for both woody plants and perennials.
Okay, so something to at least be on the lookout for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate some long-term effects from this past summer's drought?
Oh, I sure do. There's going to be a long-term effect on our woody plants. We're going to be seeing a lot of problems with borers in the next several years, not just emerald ash borer, which attacks healthy as well as stress trees, but borers are really insects that prey on trees that are under stress. And so we're going to see more two-line chestnut borer on oaks. We're going to be seeing all kinds of other on conifers. We'll be seeing pine sawyers and Ips beetle and so on. So, yes. And, of course, a lot of people worried about their turf. Is it going to come back in the spring? You know, do I have to seed? A lot of stuff.
Lots to think about. And, you know, you mentioned trees. And Ed in Milwaukee, has a question relating to trees. So let's go to him. Ed, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a mountain ash, and I think it's some type of poplar. It's, I just got married, and one's at my house, one's at my wife's house. But the main stems on them appear to have died. And, you know, the mountain ash isn't as much of a concern. It's a smaller tree. It seems to have a lot of side branches, and if I have to cut it down, that's fine. But at my wife's house, it's some type of poplar, and the main stem died. It's got a couple of rigorous side branches, but I'm worried if I cut the main stem off, is it going to survive, or am I just going to funnel water into the trunk?
Well, okay. First of all, neither of those two trees are particularly long-lived in our area. They're both very disease-prone, unfortunately. The poplar, I would say, of the two is the more likely to come back. You shouldn't leave the section that is dead on the tree, so you should go ahead and remove it. There might be some infiltration into the root system of water, you know, from the stump, but I guess I wouldn't worry about that a whole lot. Poplars do tend to grow in colonies, so you probably will see multiple branches starting again from the base, and you'll have to keep up with that if you want to keep it a single stem tree.
Yeah, both of them produced seeds.
Yep. That's not common. That's not uncommon either. Poplars, in particular, are very seedy creatures, and so I don't usually recommend them as lawn trees because you're always having to pull the things out of your lawn. The mountain ash is a beautiful tree, but very susceptible to a disease called fire blight, which is a bacterial disease, and we often see them taken out by that. They do produce berries, and sometimes the birds will spread those around. I would say if the main stem has died, you're probably, if it's grafted, going to get something from the rootstock that is less desirable. So you might want to take that one out and choose a different tree that's less disease-prone.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page. At the Larry Mueller Show, you know, you mentioned all those pests, and I guess a lot of that gets to be drought-related, doesn't it?
It certainly does. The more stress that a plant is under, the more we're likely to see problems with opportunistic organisms, be they diseases or insects, that will prey on those stressed plants.
Yeah. You know, before I forget about it, I want to bring... you and I have had a lot of fun over the years at Garden Expo.
Yes, we have.
And,
I love Garden Expo.
I do, too. It's coming up again, and let's talk about that for a minute while we're... So it's coming up the 8th through the 10th. I'll be there on the 9th. That's Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll be there on Saturday. But talk about what everybody can see when they go to Garden Expo.
Oh, Garden Expo is great. Whether you like shopping, whether you like attending seminars, whether you like meeting celebrities such as Larry, whether you want to ask gardening questions, whether you want to find out about the Master Gardener Program, that's a great place to do all of those things. There are workshops where you can learn to build things that they've had in the past. There have been things like gourd birdhouses. You can learn pruning techniques. There are many, many, many seminars. I'm teaching three of them, I think, this year. And PT, the Wisconsin Public Television, is recording some of them now, so you can enjoy some of them online if you're not able to go. But we have many of our local businesses that have examples and things to sell that they have at the expo. And Extension has a booth right near the front, near the Wisconsin Gardener booth that you can ask your gardening questions, everything from soils to recommendations for perennials and trees and diseases and insects. And Phil Pelletieri and Brian Huddleston from the university are
they're always there.
Yep. And many of our other specialists, too. So it's a great opportunity to talk to university specialists.
And Shelley, Ryan, and I, and you usually chime in, too, on this on Saturday morning. I think it's around 10 o'clock or 10:15 that we're doing a little dog and pony show, so to speak. But before that, Wisconsin Public Radio has an exhibit there, too, a booth there.
Yeah.
And there you can win. You'll have a chance to win some fabulous prizes as we have a little putting green we're setting up. I told Jeff I'd bring over my banana putter. I've got a putter that looks like a banana.
Not to be missed.
So anyway, that's. I hope you'll stop by the Wisconsin Public Radio booth as well. Say hello to. There'll be somebody there all day. I'll be there part of the day, and others will be there other parts of the day. So wanted to bring that up, and there's some Master Gardener trainings too.
Yes. If you're not familiar with the Master Gardener Volunteer Program, it's a statewide, well, it's a national program, but here in Wisconsin, it's offered in most counties. In Dane County, if you're interested in becoming a Master Gardener Volunteer, our program runs from February through the end of August, so it's definitely time to sign up. You can go to our Dane County Extension website. Just Google Dane County UWEX, and you can find information about the program. Another thing we're doing in Dane County is we have a sweet potato project where the office is partnering with a number of different organizations, including River Food Pantry and Community Action Coalition, a few others, to encourage community people to plant and harvest sweet potatoes with the end goal of donating the yield to food pantries. So
I love sweet potatoes.
Yeah, I do too. So if you go to the website www.MadisonSweetPotatoProject.org, you can sign up to receive slips, which are cuttings of sweet potatoes. We'll still be ordering in January and giving them out in late May, early June for people to order. And we've got thousands of orders already, farmers, but also community people. So if you want to join in and help on that, grow a new crop, please visit www.MadisonSweetPotatoProject.org.
Wonderful project. Dave and Racine, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, coming back to your issue about drought, and should that change how you prune trees in the winter? Specifically, I have a white ash and some red maples. Should I change? I prune more or less under conditions of drought?
Okay. All right. So we're pruning in the winter after a drought.
Right.
You won't really know until next spring, unfortunately, what's dead unless you kept track of it over the season. Now, you can always prune out dead material during the growing season, but we usually advise people to wait until dormancy this time of year to do any major pruning and shaping. I would say this year maybe be a little conservative during this dormant period because you don't know how much dieback is going to occur. A lot of the trees, they may make it through, you know, last year and look okay, but due to the stress, they may lose some branches over the winter. And again, you won't know until they leaf out in spring. So I guess I would be a little conservative this winter that you don't prune off too much in your goal of shaping the tree because, you know, you might have more dieback than you expect to have. That's a really excellent question.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, you know, Christy had sent something up on my Facebook page, and that kind of goes to what we were talking about earlier. Whether additional protection might be needed to provide hardy, mostly native perennials that are facing a major upcoming freeze without the protection of snow cover,
I would say for native plants, it's less of an issue unless they have been recently planted. The ones that have been recently planted, again, you know, if you planted them late in the fall, for instance, especially if they're in small pots, sometimes they have a tendency to heave out of the ground when we have freeze and thaw events. So if you have smaller ones, you might want to put some straw around those. Usually what we want is mulch is, there's kind of a mythology out there that mulch is used to keep the ground from freezing. That's not really true. What we're trying to do is once the ground is frozen, we want it to stay frozen. And so for new plants, when we put down winter mulch, it's to keep the ground frozen. So that's sort of the theory behind it. And again, I usually mulch in plants that I put in later in the season. And generally, I'm putting them in a bed that's mulched anyway. But I would think for native plants, again, unless they are just recently planted, you wouldn't need to do that. The ones I'm more worried about are things like coral bells that are semi-evergreen and have their growing points close to the surface or above the surface. Things like hostas that have their growing, you know, that die back completely and have their growing points underground, I'm not so worried about. But still, if we continue to have freeze-thaw. In our area, I don't think the ground ever froze. Not hard anyway, because we got snow early. So you might want to think about a little bit.
We have callers online, Andy and Dalton. We'll get to you in just a minute. Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our on-air producer here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator. Annie in Dalton has been waiting a while. And Annie, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I have a yard with quite a few spirea bushes in it of different varieties. And despite watering this year, they didn't look so good in the fall. I think I've got a lot of dieback. Is there any way to, well, how do I bring them back? Do I just trim them way down or just cut out the dead, which will make them look funny?
Well, spireas do grow up from the base usually fairly well. Mm-hmm. Of course, they probably didn't die back just around the edges or something like that. So I would cut off, I would cut off the dead material because that's obviously not going to come back. Usually what we do with spireas is there's a process that's called rejuvenation pruning. And what we do every year is we cut out, or every couple of years, it depends on how old the plant is and how dense it is, we take out a third of the biggest, oldest canes right at the base, and that encourages new sprouts to break. So I suspect that if you did water it well, that you probably will get some natural rejuvenation anyway from, you know, the stems that died. But if you go in and, again, cut out a third of those big stems, what that does is it encourages more branches to break from the base, so you'll get a thicker comeback in a less amount of time. So I still would use that method, but I'd also cut out the dead stuff, and I would keep them real well watered this year if we continue to have that sort of issue.
All righty. Well, thank you. Some of those are 50 years old, and I really don't want to lose them.
Are some old spireas.
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful.
Oh, well, they came with the house, and I know who planted them. So.
I understand why you want to keep them.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't want to be the one to lose them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Oh, and I'm just looking at my Facebook page here at the Larry Mueller Show. What did I do?
Technology is wonderful, isn't it?
Technology is wonderful. And Mike, here we go. Now I've got it again. Mike sent some photos. I looked at the first one and I thought, a lime tree. And then I see his note from Green Bay. This is my Meyer lemon, it's a lemon tree. Sorry, mm-hmm. Meyer lemon tree at 7 years old.
Wow.
We're lucky enough to have a south-southeast sunlight all winter long. She lives outdoors all summer and lives inside in the winter.
Nice.
And look at the lemons that he's got.
Wow. Those can be big honking lemons, too. I've seen some successful examples of those. If you got the light inside, and he does, they can be wonderful ornamental plants, and the flowers smell so good.
Oh, absolutely.
They do tend to be a little susceptible to spider mites and aphids over winter. So you do need to watch out for those, but looks like a great plant. Good job.
Yep, very good job. I'm a little jealous. My lime tree looks pretty good. My bear's lime looks pretty good, but doesn't have that as many limes as he's got lemons on that one. That's for sure. Go to my Facebook page if you want to take a look. You don't have to be a member of Facebook or anything. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can go there and find M. Paul. And his photos were really cool. Mike in Oconomowoc, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if I could ask a question about a pest out in the garden, more specifically about a bacteria caused by the pest called phytoplasm, brought on with yellow asters, I guess is what it's called.
And the aster yellows, yes.
Aster yellows, and the aster leafhopper is the culprit.
Right.
Is there any preventative measures I can take not to have that bacteria, phytoplasm, become apparent in the garden?
Well, unfortunately, not really. The leafhopper that carries the aster yellows phytoplasma tends to... Sorry, phytoplasm. Yeah,
phytoplasm.
tends to blow in on storms. Some years we have greater populations. Some years we have smaller populations. Of course, there are other things besides asters that they feed on. You can get aster yellows on phlox. You can get aster yellows on carrots. You can get aster yellows on coneflowers and chrysanthemums and a bunch of different things that the leafhoppers feed on. If you want to use insecticides, that might help a little bit, but I don't really recommend it because that also kills off the beneficial organisms. What you should do if you have a plant that is affected, it's not going to get any better, and it is going to serve as a source of inoculum for the phytoplasma. And so you should remove that particular plant. I had to take out a coneflower last year, and I've had to take out a number of other things.
Up in Minnesota last year, several farmers had their entire garlic crop devastated by the aster yellow.
Yes, I heard about that, actually. We had some problems in Wisconsin, too.
Yep.
Right. Fortunately for us, we have 5 acres in garlic, and we didn't have any problems.
Oh, that's good.
but we don't want any problems either.
Sure.
We heard of a product called Oxidate by BioSafe Systems that's supposed to be a preventative measure, and I've never heard of Oxidate before.
Boy, I'm not familiar with that one either. I would...
All right, we'll run that by...
Yeah, Phil Pelletieri, I would think. Phil Pelletieri, our state entomologist, some better... Yeah, for a commercial crop like that, yeah, then you probably would want to take some preventative measures. Now, since it's something like garlic, are you growing it for the bulbs, or are you growing it for flowers?
We're growing it for the seed and the bulbs. Plus, we have a bad garlic habit.
I didn't know there could be such a thing as a bad garlic habit. I was going to say, if you weren't growing it for the flowers, maybe floating row cover or some kind of product like that to exclude the things. But if you need pollination for seed, then that's a little bit of a conundrum. So I would check with Phil as to what he would recommend for that.
He's at the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go online and get his information.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for calling. Yeah, garlic. I remember my time in Trinidad was a lot of fun, and garlic is heavily used down there, and I remember somebody had given me directions for a dish, and it was called for 5 garlic, and I mm-hmm. thought it was 5 little pieces, but instead it was 5 bulbs.
Oh, my goodness. That's in one recipe?
In one.
Whoa.
One stew. And you know what? It tasted pretty good.
Yeah. It depends on the type that you use, too. Some of them are sharper flavored. Others are more mellow. But, you want to make sure everybody has some so that you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, got an email from Reva. My mother's name was Reva. My peonies were plagued with downy mildew this past summer. Cleaned up and got rid of the foliage in the fall. Anything I should be doing in the spring to prevent a recurrence?
Well, okay. Downy mildew obviously is different than powdery mildew. For a peony bush, when it's not a tree peony or something like that, and you can cut off any affected foliage, that certainly is very helpful. The thing with downy mildew and most other mildews is that they are usually pretty host specific. So if you get downy mildew on your, basil or something like that,
yeah,
which we're now seeing some problems with that, it's not going to be on another genus like rose, for example. But it, just like with powdery mildew, if you see one plant that has it, you know the conditions are right for another plant to get it, even though it's a different species of the downy mildew. Usually, you can, you know, by removing the affected material, you should be okay. But there are products that you can use. Copper sulfate, for example, is one. Lime is another, you know, Bordeaux mix types of things. If you see the problem happening again. Now, most of our fungicides tend to be protective in nature rather than curative. So if we have the same sorts of conditions next year, even though you've cleaned up real well around the area, you might want to preventively or proactively, prophylactically, I guess that's the word I'm looking for, apply one of those types of products. And, you know, certainly if you start to see symptoms, you need to do something. Downy mildew can be a far more serious problem than powdery mildew, which tends to just be cosmetic and annoying. And downy mildew can actually cause damage or even death of your plants.
John in Mequon, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry and guest. I appreciate the opportunity to ask you a question, and that's regarding planting trees in heavy clay soil. I did that about 4 years ago. Planted two trees at the bottom of a slight incline or slope on my property, which is maybe the slope went down maybe 4 feet, 3 feet. And water, either after a rainstorm or after the sprinkler system, water gathers around the, the mulch around the root ball. And, of course, it has been suffering from dieback and stunting these two trees. Now, I am thinking of raising them up, digging down the root ball, raising them up and making a little berm. And also this heavy clay, which is maybe 6 inches underneath the soil, removing some of that, augmenting it, putting in some topsoil or a mix in there so that it might make a little better draining. Would I be doing the right approach to this situation?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. Usually, particularly in heavy clay soils, we don't recommend heavily amending because you tend to create a bathtub effect.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really help. What we usually for trees, we recommend not amending the soil heavily anyway. If you've got really crummy soil like that, I think probably you need to look at your species selection. You want to choose trees that come from river bottom situations where they're species that can handle that kind of thing. So things like Freeman maple. You may want to even look at something like curly willow. Yeah, river birch, as long as the pH isn't too high. Have you had a soil test done?
No.
Okay. You might want to check the pH. River birch would be an excellent choice, but it doesn't like real high alkalinity in the soil. And I know that your area of the state is pretty alkaline. But there are a number of trees. Actually, I did a presentation once on planting trees in heavy clay soil. But you've got two things going against you. You've got your topography, which is you've got it at the bottom of a slope where water collects. And you've got heavy clay soil, so you've got kind of a double whammy going there.
Yeah, very hard.
Yeah. Is there any way that you can locate the tree elsewhere?
Yeah, I think that's my option. And river birch, does it like full sun?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yeah.
Worth a look.
Yeah, definitely worth a look. There are some other plants that will take heavy clay soil, but not necessarily the flooding situation. Things like Kentucky coffee tree and ginkgo and hackberry. Hackberry also doesn't like alkaline soils. But there are some trees out there that can handle it.
Yeah.
Well, I'll get my soil tested ASAP.
All righty. Thanks a lot, John, for calling. Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, our guest. Thank you for listening in on this edition of Garden Talk. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org with a question, or go to my Facebook page. I'd love to see the photos. We've had some great ones posted already today. If you have a photo or a question, just go to my Facebook page. The title of the page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's where to go. And open lines, we can get you on pretty quickly. Maury in Stevens Point. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. Great to be here. I have about 7 citrus trees, which I haul back and forth every year. One of them is about 20 years old. The other one's about 40 years old, bigger ones. The oldest one is a kumquat tree. This year, it's completely filled with kumquats. There's literally 200-300 kumquats on it.
Oh, my goodness.
They're very small. They're very small. The other tree is a grapefruit tree I planted from start and with a seed. And
oh,
it's
wow.
20 years old. And it's finally produced 2 grapefruits, but they're about an inch in diameter. I don't know. I guess I got a question. Should I fertilize these plants a lot during this time of the year? They seem to, any amount of water you pour on them, they seem to like. That doesn't seem to bother them in any way.
Yeah, they generally, when grown as houseplants, like a sandier soil with good drainage, but they also do like some organic matter mixed into it. If you're just using regular sunlight, or are you supplementing with a grow light?
The grapefruit tree has a grow light shining on it, and it also has the best exposure.
Okay.
The kumquat is in the living room and only has a western exposure.
Okay. Generally, when you're just using natural light, we don't recommend fertilizing most plants a whole lot during the winter because we're not getting the amount of light that we would in the summer. The plants are not growing as fast. They can't use it anyway. So I don't recommend fertilizing heavily during the winter. You can start fertilizing again in April, but usually we withhold it unless you want to put down slow release. If you use the slow release granules, usually you only have to do it every 8 months. So usually what I'll do is I'll put them on in April and then, kind of let it peter out over the winter and then put it back on again in April.
One more question. Is it good to spray them with water? That seems to help the leaf drop.
Yeah, they're very susceptible to spider mites and aphids when they're inside over the winter, and sometimes by keeping the humidity up and physically spraying, you can dislodge some of those insects if they're there. I would say that is helpful. They do like humidity. You may want to try some pebble trays with water, to try and increase the humidity kind of in a microclimate, but if they're large trees, that's going to be a little harder to do. Maybe a humidifier in the room with them, that might help as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the trees is in with the jacuzzi, so...
Shouldn't be a problem then.
Yeah.
Thanks, Maury. Appreciate the call. Tim sent us a Facebook comment, and we were just talking about garlic. He said, did you know that garlic is good for weight loss? You don't actually lose any weight, but you do look thinner from a distance. I like that one. Good one, Tim. Good one. Bill Davis had a comment on the website. You mentioned the Madison Sweet Potato Project, and where you need to go. The website is MadisonSweetPotatoProject.org, and I think you may have left out the word project. So.
Oh, okay.
So it's MadisonSweetPotatoProject.org or O-R-G. And let's see. We've got Ron in Evansville next with a question. Ron, hi.
Hello. Yes, I have some apple trees. I planted them about 5 years ago. This will be the 5th year. I don't get flowers out of them. One of them is kind of tipping over, and I'm thinking... I have horrendous Japanese beetle problems, and I've recently learned that part of their life cycle is in the roots. I'm wondering if these beetles could be wrecking the roots of these trees, and if that could be part of why one of the trees tipping over and why I don't get flowers. And if they do, are there anything you can do about these beetles?
Okay, first I need to ask some questions about the trees. Are these dwarf or semi-dwarf, or are they standard trees?
They're not dwarf. I don't think they're semi. I think they're standard trees.
Okay.
And they're about of a, right now they're coming on a 3.5-inch caliper approximately,
okay.
Maybe a little bigger.
Many times a standard tree takes 5 to 7 years to really start producing. And while it is unusual that they wouldn't even flower, I doubt that it's a problem that the Japanese beetles are causing. Japanese beetles prefer to feed on turf roots, so if you have grass around the trees, they might be feeding on that, but they often will fly in from other areas, particularly if you're close to, for example, a golf course or a sod farm, or if you irrigate.
Cemetery.
Cemetery. Well, any place that turf is well cared for, and watered heavily, they love that. This doesn't mean, of course, that, you know, there may be a few of them chewing on the roots of your apple trees, but generally not going to cause that sort of issue. I would be more suspicious of, are the trees in enough light? What is the soil like? And again, the age of the trees, because again, it's not unusual for apple trees that are standards not to be bearing for several years.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you.
I should say, though, for the Japanese beetles, I sure wish we had a silver bullet. The thing that Phil Pelletieri keeps saying is that often when they're really horrendous, like you say, in an area, that will last for about 5 years, and then the population will kind of level out as they move into new areas, unless you're near a ground zero sort of thing like a golf course.
There you go, Ron. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest for today, Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. Rebecca in the Platteville area is up next on the phone. By the way, there are open lines. You can join us on the phone, excuse me, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Rebecca now. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I have three questions. One, I have Virginia bluebells that are flourishing under walnut trees and have done so for 35 years. But I'd like to transplant some of them, and the little buggers disappear after they flower, and I don't know when you can do that safely.
Oh, okay. Well, if you want to, probably the very best time to do it would be while they're dormant, and what you might want to do is stick a flag or a label into the ground so that you'll know where they are. The roots are really weird looking. They're like flat pieces of bark, and you want to plant them at about the same level that they were in the ground in the other place. But you can transplant them in early spring when they're just starting to come up. You can do that too, but you might not get as good of a flower display, and they might be a little stunted for that year.
Okay. Second question. I have a garlic mustard infestation.
My sympathies.
Coming up through my woodlot, I mean my neighbor's mm-hmm. woodlot, and normally I don't use sprays, but these little suckers come up everywhere. I mean,
yeah.
Even in the gravel.
Yep.
I mean, it's just amazing where they've showed up. And I got to get them. And I don't know what's the right time and with what I should use.
Okay. If it's spread to the point where you can't control it by hand pulling, you can use Roundup. That does work. And you can spray Boy.
But there's Jack in the Pulpit and stuff around.
Yeah,
some
so
of
you,
it, and I don't want to kill them.
Right. What you would need to do is you need to spray early in the season before any of that comes up. So
okay.
That may be early April. It may be end of March, depending on our weather. Last
yeah.
year, the garlic mustard got going gonzo earlier in the season. But you should not spray while your other spring ephemerals and other wildflowers are up. You can also do it in the fall because garlic mustard is semi-evergreen. The problem is that at that time of year, you're contending with seed pods that might still
yes.
be left, and so you really don't want to be messing around in there where you might transport the seed around. Another thing that land managers do is sometimes they'll leave the first year seedlings because the plant has a 2-year life cycle and it blooms the second year. So they will take care of the flowering plants to make sure that they don't get any further seed production. And, you know, if they can't get to it all that year, that's a management technique. Another thing about garlic mustard is that it does have allelopathic roots, which means that they put out a chemical that affects other plants nearby. So you do, you know, if you do have those Jack in the Pulpit and some other plants that you want to preserve, I would make sure that you remove the garlic mustard from around them immediately. Another piece of bad news is that the seeds can remain viable in the soil for 5 to 7 years. So once you get an infestation started, it'll seem like you're just battling and battling. My brother has an infestation out in his land in Blue Mounds, and it just once it gets going, it's horrible stuff. It's considered an invasive species, and DNR and Extension also have publications about it that you may want to learn more about it online.
If I never had it, but my neighbor recently bought the place behind me. And they have these all-terrain vehicles, and I suspect
they brought
it in with their tires.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they went round and round, and that's where it's been coming. And, of course, it's coming to my land, and it's like, I don't know, guys, spray your tires.
Yeah.
But I think it's hopeless. I have one more question. I planted some crabapple trees, and I have two horses, two donkeys. They've never bothered anything, but I don't know if it was the donkeys, but the three crab apples that I planted, I have trunk protectors, those spirals.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Above that, they stripped it.
That could be
hope?
Deer, actually. Is there,
no,
could...
I saw a donkey do it.
Oh,
so
you did? Mad donkey.
Donkey. So I was yelling glue at him and everything, but he was
impressed. Didn't impress him, huh?
And they're well fed, so it's not that. But I don't know, it got into boredom or something. But is there any hope? Because of the spiral trunk protector protected the bottom.
So they stripped the leaves off, are you saying?
No, they stripped the bark above the spiral.
No.
That's bad news. If it's all the way around the trunk, most likely the plant will not survive because it's cut off the vascular system so it can't pull up water from the ground anymore. That system is located right below the bark. So when we see bark girdled like that, that's usually not a good sign. If there is some bark left, you may just have some dieback and, you know, part of the tree will live. But if it's a lot, it probably will look so bad that you'll wish it had died. So you might as well take it out. Sometimes it's interesting. Sometimes they have enough water stored in the roots that they'll push out buds in the spring and then die later. So sorry to be the bearer of bad news there.
All right, Rebecca, thank you for calling. We had an email from Amanda who has a little leaf linden, or had, I should say. It died 10 years ago. Grew it back from one of the suckers off the root. It's now a beautiful tree, but seems to be dying again. More and more dead limbs the last two springs. Should we give up on this species?
Well, there's a number of things that could be happening. When I hear things like dead limbs appearing over a period of time, kind of scattered in the tree, I have to wonder about verticillium wilt, which is a soil-borne pathogen. And that is a terminal thing. The other thing that could be happening is there's a linden borer, so it could have borers getting into the base of the tree and affecting the vascular system. I'd look for holes in the trunk and frass, which is this sawdusty-like material. Another thing is it might be that it's in a droughty area and last year affected it particularly badly. Lindens are also subject if they're next to the curb, for example. They can tend to get marginal burn. A lot of different things that could be causing that, unfortunately.
Kate in Wisconsin Rapids, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a horse farm, an 80-acre horse farm I bought in 96. And, of course, we had lots of oak on it at the time that many were diseased, but they still looked good. Well, we've lost most of those oak, have some that are just standing, and it's my favorite tree. I was told by an arborist that I believe it's the white oak, the same type of oak that they planted at Ground Zero in New York, are pretty resilient to oak wilt. And I wondered if that was true and worth the risk of having some planted up by our house. I know I could benefit from them.
Well, they're exactly true.
They're more resistant.
They're more resistant and more tolerant to it, but it can kill them. It just kills them more slowly than it does with red oak. The red oak and black oak are very susceptible. They have a differently structured vascular system that allows the fungus to spread very quickly and kill the plants very quickly. With the white oaks, they're able to wall the pathogen off a little bit in their vascular system, but they may survive for a number of years if they're infected. I guess if you wanted to plant them, you should put them in an area that's far away from the other oaks, because this can also spread through root grafts. Typically, when you have oaks growing in a forested situation, you do have root grafts underground between the trees. But the thing is that the beetle that causes this is a stress-related beetle. So you're going to see more of it, I'm afraid, in the next few years because we have stressed out our oaks with the drought. I guess if it were me, I wouldn't be planting any more for the next few years just because the beetle population is going to be higher. And because you're in a high-risk area, I'm not so sure I'd recommend it. If you really, really wanted some, again, plant them far away, and you'd probably have to treat them prophylactically every couple of years, you know, with a tree injection of fungicide. And I hate to recommend that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because that's putting a lot of chemical out there.
Would it make any difference, the fact that our house was built up, it was raised because the water table is real high here, and so it's probably almost 4 acres or 5 acres where the house is, and there are some dead oaks on the corner of off the property. Would it be safer with that ground if I did it farther away from the dead oaks and waited, like you said, a couple of years to have the stress get by? And obviously it sounds like even then I'd have to baby it.
You'd have to baby it. When you have a population of those beetles that transmit the fungus and you have standing, you know, trees that have an active infection, now after the tree dies, of course, the fungus will die as well. But if you have trees that are still infected, then, you know, you have some inoculum there. So you would have to baby it with those fungicide treatments.
Any spectacular tree that you would recommend besides the gorgeous old oaks?
Yeah.
Oh,
I wouldn't live long enough to see the oaks get like they are on the property now,
sure.
But still.
There are a number of beautiful shade trees. Kentucky coffee tree is one that is, yeah, it's a lovely tree. You want to make sure you get a male, though, unless you don't mind dealing with the pods. But that is a particularly nice one. We have a number of native trees besides that. We have hackberry, although you need to worry about the pH a little with that one. There are other species of oak, but I'm not going to recommend those.
Yeah. So there you have it, Kate. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck with the trees. That coffee tree, the Kentucky coffee is
that's a really, and it has kind of the same look as an oak.
Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. You know, it's so much fun to garden. A lot of fun to be outside. We put a lot of energy into it, and we're lucky to have Lisa with us because she does a wonderful job answering questions about this whole broad range of topics that we get into every single time we have a Garden Talk show. A lot of fun, and great to have her along, and certainly great to have you listening in. Thanks so much for doing that. And lots of callers online. Let me give you the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call. Richard in Fitchburg, been waiting a long time, so I think we'll just go right to Richard. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I had a question in regards to, and I may have missed this earlier, the Japanese beetles. About 4 or 5 years ago when they first started coming in, became my problem, it spread some milky spore and basically covered, you know, all our neighbors and everything. We spoke to everybody and everybody agreed. So probably about 100 yards. 200, 300 yards in each direction. And last year I noticed that there weren't that many Japanese beetles, but I wasn't sure if that was because of the weather or whether that was a factor of this milky spore finally taking place. So I'm not sure about other areas, but we certainly didn't have anywhere near the problem we'd had prior years. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Well, there are a number of things that might be going on. First of all, if you're not near a golf course or other highly manicured lawn setting where the turf is not highly fertilized and watered, a lot of your beetles tend to come in from other areas. So if your turf is not highly watered, then they're coming in. And the thing with Japanese beetles that Phil Pelletieri is seeing is that normally they will invade an area, be a big problem for 5-6 years, and then the populations start to level off. The thing with milky spore is that if your beetles are coming in from another area, such as a golf course, then even though you're treating and your neighbors are treating, they're very strong flyers, so they can come in, you know, regardless of that. Now, if you don't have a golf course nearby and you do have neighbors that are willing to invest in that, it can work. Phil is not recommending it, however, because he says that research has shown that the strains of the bacillus that they're using now are not as effective as strains that they used to use a number of years ago, and it's an expensive product. It will work if you have high levels of beetles in your turf. But they have to be, it affects the grubs. So if you don't have a high level of grubs actually overwintering and laying eggs in your turf and the larva living in your turf, then it's not going to help much.
There we go. We have Kat sent us on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show if you're listening in. Go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show for a photo here from Kat. She says, I believe I have spider mites in my plants. Here's a photo. I've rinsed plants, given up, and thrown them out. And I wish I washed them down and left that corner of the house empty for a month or so. This is a plant I brought inside. It looks like it's back, but that photo is not showing me spider mites.
No, what it's showing us is mealybugs. And mealybugs are a sucking insect, which is the same thing that spider mites do, but they make these waxy sort of nests where they lay their eggs, and each insect is also waxy. If you go to our Brian Huddleston's plant disease diagnostics page, we have a nice fact sheet on them. They do love coleus. I have had this problem many, many times with coleus, and I can't keep mealybugs off of them in the winter. You can spray with neem oil. That might be effective. Another thing you can do if you have a small infestation is to use rubbing alcohol and a Q-tip, and you just touch it to the mass. It penetrates the wax, and it kills them. But it looks like from your picture you have a pretty heavy infestation.
Yeah.
What you might want to do is start from cuttings, you know, clean the cuttings off. Just water isn't going to do it because of that waxy coat. You really need to use an insecticide or, again, the alcohol swabs. From the look of that plant, I would say toss it in a closed bag and start over again. If there are any leaves or anything on the floor, make sure to sweep those up and get rid of them as well. They can also hang around in the root system. So if you have other plants, you might just want to check in the pot, you know, to make sure right around the roots that they aren't actually in the soil there and providing a reservoir of insects.
Thanks a lot, Kat, for that. It's a good place to go. Actually, that photo is a really good example to really show you what they look like.
Yeah, it's an excellent example. And that website is pddc.uwex, or is it .whiskeydoo? Oh, shoot. Maybe Dave can put that up on our page for me. Mm-hmm. I can't believe it. I can't remember that one.
Well, we'll get
if
it.
If you just Google PDDC and WISC, you should be able to, or even just Wisconsin, you should be able to come up with it.
We've got Jeff in Appleton next with a question. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Lisa. I purchased an acre lot here in the Appleton area last April, and it's a wooded lot, but I'd like to create more privacy. One of the caveats is I do have a heavy population of deer that roam the area. And the front of the home has some nice paper birch, and I'd like to supplement them because I know that they're towards the end of their lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to put some river birch in.
Sure.
But I'd like to create more of a privacy area. The pines that we're creating there were taken down in a storm a few years ago. And I'd like to supplement that and create a little more of an isolation area. And if Larry remembers, I live in a double envelope home, and I have about 40 feet of nothing but glass windows solarium. And I'd like your top five plants to put in that, because I am not educated in that area.
Oh, wow. Well, you could certainly grow some citrus.
Yeah, absolutely.
In that area.
Yeah,
gardenias, hibiscus, that would all be great stuff for a solarium type of environment.
Well,
that's
you.
Lucky you.
Yeah, that's great.
You can even grow tomatoes in the winter and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the Bear's Lime, I'm still quite a proponent of it. They're wonderful lime trees. And we've got a beautiful shot of some Meyer lemons tree on the Facebook page, too.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's all really cool stuff. Now, as for your deer problem, we have a great publication from Dr. Laura Jull from the UW that's called Plants That Are, Not Attractive to Plants Not Favored by Deer. And that's at thelearningstore.uwex.edu. If you just Google learning store, all one word, you'll probably come up with that. And it gives a lot of recommendations. One thing you don't want to plant is arborvitae, because that's like number one on their
favorite food list.
I have a section of beautiful arborvitae. The only problem is they're all about 9 feet up in the air.
Yes. Yeah, they've gotten the branches as far up as they can reach. There is a type of arborvitae, Thuja plicata, the western arborvitae, that is a little bit less palatable to deer, but if you've got a high population, I wouldn't go for it. Pines, though, would be an option, possibly spruce. I think Serbian spruce is on the list of plants that deer don't favor, but you might want to check the publication first.
Mm-hmm. I will.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Good luck with that.
And Gary and Rhinelander, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I've been here this wintertime looking through seed magazines for planting out my garden.
Uh-huh.
And looking basically at tomato plants. And I've seen something new, at least something new to me, that they're grafting tomato plants onto other rootstock.
That's true. Yeah.
And so is this something that I should definitely get involved in? Meaning, I believe a lot of my plants have got some sort of blight last year.
Mm.
I'm going to be, send you guys pictures to make sure that that's what it is, but... So you recommend that I could, purchase a few of these and try them out?
Sure. They tend to be quite expensive. So just to save you the sticker shock, usually they're about $6 or $7 a plant. If you've not had major problems, you might not want to invest in them, but particularly people that grow a lot of tomatoes and maybe have problems with rotating the plants because they don't have a lot of areas with sun, might be interested in doing that. They are something that, there's good science behind it, that some tomatoes have root systems that are more resistant to soil-borne problems. And so the industry has started doing that with some of these, but you generally have to buy them already grafted. If you wanted to do it yourself, there is information on the internet about what varieties to use, but it's kind of an arduous process to not only graft them, but have them survive. There's a video through Johnny Select Seeds that has the whole process that they use. It's very cool. I've seen it. And actually, I use it in my Master Gardener training. I give them the link if they want to see how it's done.
Oh, great. So getting them through the mail, is okay?
Yeah, that's fine. The one problem with mail order is, if you do, and sometimes we end up with pathogens, from places south of us, if they come from, say, Georgia or Kentucky or Alabama or something like that, you can bring in pathogens. So if you can buy them locally, I would recommend that at a garden center.
Well, it is a Wisconsin seed magazine, so.
Okay.
Yeah. Then you're good.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Jerry emailed us and said, we have several ash, oak, maple, and basswood. I watered them extensively last summer. I was told they should be fertilized twice a year. I was told not to use spikes, which I used last year. What should I use? Twice a year fertilizing?
Actually, Dr. Laura Gell has some research that shows that, in general, trees should not be fertilized, particularly mature trees, unless there is a nutrient deficiency. You shouldn't need to do that. They're right about the spikes. I definitely would not recommend the spikes because you tend to get a buildup, particularly of nitrogen, in the area where those spikes are, and they don't disperse very well in the soil, so you can burn your roots. But in general, again, unless you have very poor soils, you should not fertilize your trees, and certainly not twice a year.
Jeff and Mequon, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, about 6 years ago, I planted a small ginkgo tree, and within a year, I did a lot of damage to the trunk of the tree, and I figured, well, it's not going to grow, and I just left it alone. Now I notice that a single sucker has grown up through the center of it. It's beautifully straight, and it, you know, the original tree is kind of scraggly looking. So I'm wondering, should I just cut the old tree off and let the sucker grow? Or would it grow into a tree, or should I just cut the sucker out?
Is your tree grafted? Do you know? Or
I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Is there a bump where at the ground level?
Kind of like
stem?
A bubble,
yeah.
Almost like appearance?
Or is it pretty straight?
I don't recall. I did so much damage to it. I hit it with a chain that it almost ripped it in half.
Oh my goodness.
But the sucker now is like volume wise, you know, weight wise is probably about the size of the original tree.
Yeah. And is the original tree, what size is that?
They're both about an inch to inch and a half, say about an inch and a half caliper.
Okay.
About 6 feet high, 7 feet.
Okay. All right. Let me tell you the two scenarios here. If your tree was grafted, then it might be a sucker that's coming up from the root system. So you might have it grafted onto a female rootstock, and then you might potentially get fruits at some point in time. Just the species is likely to grow a little bit faster than a grafted cultivar. Generally, we have selections that are the male selections are vegetatively reproduced, and generally they aren't grafted, but I think some of the dwarf ones might be grafted. I guess I'm just a little concerned that where this sucker is coming from. If it's coming from above ground, you're probably okay. And if you did want to take out that center, you know, they're the original. Generally, we don't want to prune more than 25% off the tree at once because it's a big shock and loss of food resources. So I would take it out little by little if that's what you want to do. If the sucker is coming from below ground, it's probably not grafted, but the thing is that they take about 15 years or 20 years to actually fruit. So, you know, if you're not going to be at that house very long, maybe you don't mind leaving that problem for the next person. But if you're looking at this as a long term, I just not sure.
What is the fruit of a ginkgo? I mean, is it a problem around here?
It is because it's a beautiful little fruit. It looks like an apricot, but it smells like dirty socks.
Yeah, it's a terrible smell.
We have some out, or did have some out in front of the building here, Larry, that were females, and I think they eventually took them down.
Yep.
They're also very slimy when they fall on the ground, and so if you have them near sidewalks like they did here, it can be a bit of an issue. It is pretty raunchy.
Slimy, dirty socks.
Yeah, yeah, it's not pleasant. So that's why you always want to get male ginkgos. Again, it's not likely that it's grafted, but, you know, there's a possibility.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Jeff, for calling. Ben wonders in an email, what's the best time to trim trees around the house? The evergreens, the maples, and the bushes. Now's as good as any, isn't it?
Usually you want to do most of your pruning during the dormant season, but for pines, you generally just want to prune the candles, which are the new growth, and that's done in the spring.
Bob, good point. Mary from Wauwatosa had a major problem with rust on her roses. Oh, I have about 35 bushes, mostly Radler and other generally resistant varieties.
Wow.
Yeah, will a cold winter help eliminate this problem?
Well, rust is a fungal disease, and it can overwinter on plants, so you want to make sure that you took off all the leaves. Sometimes what people will do, rosarians, as they call them, will sometimes actually spray the ground for things like black spot and rust around the area where the roses are planted. You can use a dormant oil spray like lime sulfur. I like to do that kind of thing in the late fall because it is rather it's fragrant.
Yeah.
That's not the best word for it. Odoriferous would be a better term. Can be an issue. I haven't heard much of a problem with that generally on resistant roses, so it may have been a stress thing. But you may want to email Brian Huddleston at the Disease Diagnostic Clinic about that. I have a vague memory about him maybe saying that he was seeing more of it this year.
Julie in Appleton, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. I have a follow-up question to the gentleman who called about the grafted tomatoes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering, first of all, what are they grafted to? And second of all, I am in a position where I can really only do container gardening at this point. And I have a wonderful container to do that in. But I just was questioning, A, what it would be, and B, if it would be a problem to be replanting over and over in that container.
Yes, it is a problem to replant over and over in the container if you're using the same soil and not cleaning out the container. You could probably get away with it for a couple of years, but what tends to happen is that pathogens will build up, particularly if you're using any actual soil or compost. Now, if you're just using soilless mix, you're less likely to import any pathogens in there. But, you know, some of these things are, you get them floating through the air and then they land on your leaves. And, you know, things like early blight can end up in the soil if the plant material that's affected falls onto the soil. So we still recommend crop rotation even in pots. And the tomatoes are grafted to resistant tomato varieties.
So that was my major question.
Yep.
I didn't know if it was some other strange vegetable.
No, it's just a more resistant tomato variety, but that doesn't necessarily have great fruit. So you graft the desired fruit onto the resistant rootstock.
There you go.
Okay.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you so much for calling. And boy, look at the time. The time has flown, Lisa.
It does that, doesn't it?
It really does. And I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Look forward to your next visit.
Me too. Thanks.
Appreciate it very much. She does a great job, doesn't she? Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. She'll be back. We'll do it again. And thanks a lot for listening. Really appreciate it. On Monday, we'll talk about the Great Meat Cookbook. Stay with us here on the IdeasNet.